All right, good morning. It's about 6:05 a.m. here, October 8, 2022, coming at you live from a beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. Forgive me, I have some congestion. There were some cookies left out. I don't know who left them out, but there were some cookies left out. It's not my fault what happened to them. But now I have a... That was a couple days ago. Now I have like a runny nose. Whenever you have symptoms that people call like a cold or a flu, just think about how much maybe sugar you've had like in maybe 3-4 days prior, something like that. You're gonna get a lot of mucus and congestion and headaches. Anyway, so as we are doing a pre-dawn live stream with you here, and it works out this way. Actually, I could have started at 3 a.m. I might do that. We're getting too close, actually, to the morning here. The whole operation of Casa Flores is a paramilitary operation involving several infants. So you have very good questions for me today. Ranging from like Khazar, Khazar, Dugin. See, I you know, we can see it's I still have the DMT flowing from my my sleep, I think. It's like pre-dawn. Anyway, I think it's the hour before the sunlight. Hit the sunlight. It's like, no, we just can't talk about that stuff. But I think I think there should be nothing controversial about my opinions on that. But we'll get into it. May surprise you, may, you know. Hopefully entertain you. Are you not entertained? The main problem right now, well, people have asked also about, sorry, before we get into it, people also asked about Elon Musk, and I'm not going to list all the questions now, but I'm just giving you for instances of questions I'm sure that we'll be getting into. It's good that these are all good questions, because they had been on my mind before you asked them, so that means that they're kind of part of the collective, you know, question. It's on everybody's mind. And no less with Elon Musk. I think if you are like from the United States and kind of follow what was going on with Elon Musk and like the last US election, wherein afterwards the Atlantic, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, multiple other thises and thats of them all covered a particular maneuver, a stratagem employed, had a variety of tactics, led by John Podesta, who many believe is a pedivore, or at least child abuser, Huma Abedin, back in the news. So a number of years ago, a video emerged and it was kind of quickly scrubbed that appeared to show, or just believed by many, Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin torturing a girl and then sort of eating her pieces of her and torturing her while she was alive. Some say it depicted the removal of her face entirely. It was just a mess. Now, in the some of the occult literature, I don't know about that much about, say, for example, Freemasons, okay, but in like what's considered the Western occult, kind of more connected to things that were like theosophic, even though some aspects of the origins of theosophy, theosophic matters were attempts to kind of further publicize some of the things that which earlier or later were, had come out of Freemasonry. But I mean, that's all connected to the general tradition of what you could call European Orientalism. Not to be confused with Said Orientalism, which is about, the construct of the so-called Oriental psyche in the Western mind. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about Orientalism. I'm talking about tropes or, stereotypes. But rather, a great, you might say, reverence for, trying to understand, the secrets of ancient Egypt or something like this, or the secrets of the Quran, or the secrets of the yogas, things like that. But the Muslim, the Muslim Brotherhood connection that people often draw upon talking about Huma Abedin, it is correct to ask these questions. Now, like the thing with the Muslim Brotherhood is that it's been really tied into British intelligence for a very long time. And in deep in the British intelligence network is a shared practice system or kind of a cult secret religion or something like that, like a mystery religion or a secret, not a mystery religion in the sense of how Christianity is called a mystery religion, but more in the sense of a religion that's supposed to be for the ruling class as an independent religion. See, one of the things that kind of, and we'll stay on our point in general, but kind of one of the things that people take for granted is the universality of religion, which is a little bit more unique, not unique, but it includes, but it's limited to only a few others, like the Abrahamic religions, well, at least two of them. And so the thing that, in other words, that anyone can be a part of it, okay? But in Chaldean civilizations, like the Babylonian, Mesopotamian, et cetera, were different sometimes phrases for the similar overlapping periods in the same region along, in the Tigris and Euphrates area, you would have or even to a certain extent, originally a lot of Zoroastrianism functions this way. Zoroastrians can only have like families with Zoroastrians, etc. And whereas the populations had mythologies, the ruling class had religion. And it was like a tool and a weapon of the ruling class until, I guess, what they call the axial period, where you get this rise of characters like Buddha, like Manis, as in like Manichaeanism, and Christianity. And of course, others have pointed out that Manis and then, you know, Buddha, and of course, Manis is the Buddha Christ. Manis is depicted as the Buddha, but he was born on December 25th to a virgin named Mary. So it's all very weird. But then in the way that we officially talk about Manis is that, well, he was a Christian, or he had been influenced by Christianity or something like that. It's like, well, seems when you look at the books about Manis that were from the religion have been destroyed, they say they don't exist, but in some apologetics and in polemics of surrounding faith, Manichaeanism is described. But there were, in the early church, Christian church, there were overlapping with Manichaeanism and some thinking, just in the very early church before, you know, very, very, you know, three centuries before the, you know, Nicene Christianity. It's not, we mean the church in the sense of the way that Christ means it, not like a single organized body per se, although they had networks and they would travel around, meet each other, like the priests and the believers. But you had despite that there's truth to the idea that there's connective tissue between all of the great truths in the world's religions. While it's true that the early European Orientalists were fascinated with this, and you know, this was a phenomenon that doesn't really have an origin, okay, because, well, everyone knows about Marco Polo and things like that, but there were many, many, many others. And not all of them were like mercantile. In fact, many of them were not. Many of them were cultural, philosophical, religious, especially when you get into like the 1600s and 1700s. All of this is like in the history of Western occultism. Okay. And the British intelligence is connected to that as well. And the Muslim Brotherhood, as it was effectively created by the British out of networks that had been organized as an independent force originally, but it was co-opted in its first, you know, I don't know, 25 days of existence or something like this. I mean, we don't have to say that obviously it would have occurred to people where this was started, the Muslim Brotherhood, that they would need to, you know, while fighting back the Ottomans, that the British also probably didn't have their best interests at heart. But nevertheless, the British pretty early on had control of the Muslim Brotherhood. If you find things that say that the Muslim Brotherhood was created to oppose the British something something, well, it's only false in the sense that it's incomplete information. Similarly, for example, yes, you know, Bismarck, Kaiser believed that, you know, sending the Lenin into Russia to further into a different, you know, chaotic or pull out of the war stage of the revolution, which had already, you know, they had been involved in also somewhat with the first white revolution, but then furthering it and to steer it away from Kerensky and a direction amenable to the Germans, you know, they sent Lenin, you know, on a train with all this money. That's different from the money that came from the German socialists. That was a very different set of money from the Second International. That was the money that Parvus got to Trotsky. And that's why Trotsky was his independent force. He wasn't really a Bolshevik. He actually had an independent group. And they kind of merged with the Bolsheviks, but his was smaller, but really well-financed. And it was from this real estate genius in Germany, who was also a Marxist sympathetic to events in Russia, who was a member of the Socialist Party in Germany and got the money out of dealings from New York. And previously Trotsky had been in New York. So all that stuff is true. Okay. But that would be true. But then it would be incomplete because it doesn't explain then what happened later when Stalin wrestled power away from the foreign plots within the party. And then basically the execution of the Trotskyites and the left opposition. When Trotsky, basically the so-called left, the radical leftists of the communists were eliminated by Stalin. But they were, you know, they were trying to do these stabilizing things, kind of like this theory of permanent revolution meant that the Soviet Union had to keep militarily attacking its neighbors. And Stalin didn't think that was very prudent to do. But when Trotsky was leading the Red Army, he pursued a number of like failed incursions, leading to further suspicions about what the hell is really going on. But anyway, so likewise with the Muslim Brotherhood, or with the Young Turks, okay, you don't, it is often, can be false to either attribute some kind of grandiose conspiracy of manipulative, you know, godlike powers of the ruling class, like that create all of these movements and blah, 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 blah. And in my experience and in my research, that doesn't appear to be the case, although these things tend to be organic in character in many ways, but that doesn't prohibit or preclude the fact that often intelligence networks can, you know, take these over sometimes sooner than later, but in many more cases than not. Business doesn't keep business together, right? Businesses parting ways and doing other things. And likewise, in diplomacy and international relations, although the financial aspect is not the prime motivator, whereas it's, you know, stability and security, right? Or if the status quo is amenable, preserving the status quo, basically. It's similar in that you have to build, in other words, if alliances are no longer rational, to more rational calculations of maybe how the national interest is understood by your academics and your intelligence services and things like that, then you would need to basically kind of part ways and, you know, build different alliances. And so often economics and power and, you know, pipeline geopolitics is driving this stuff, but you have to be free to be able to kind of change alliances is part of what being a sovereign country is involved. So nevertheless, when you find sort of unilateral alliance pact projects. These are based on what are called land powers, okay, which you can like think of as being telluric powers. And then the thalassocratic powers, the sea powers, are different because of the historical sea lines. It arise out of like the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and even to the 20th century, it's the supremacy of navies, you know, to be supplanted in whatever by, you know, depending on the theater, you know. The U.S. certainly never has been designed to do a land war in Eurasia, which is where this conflict is right now. Vietnam-type operations better explain or the orientation until, you know, through the 80s and 90s, and then they, and the PNAC and those people then kind of reimagined it. And now again, now they're like basically going to eliminate the Marines now in the U.S. are basically going to eliminate the Marine Corps. I mean, the honors will still exist, and it'll still exist, and everything. Anyway, so with Huma Abedin, there's a, her family's very important Muslim Brotherhood power brokers, and she's been the sort of like the politics gossip rag stuff, like remember the stuff that JFK Jr. kind of would, you know, write about in George. This was like the secret lesbian love affair between Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton. See, Hillary Clinton thinks that she's like both Sharon Stone and a genius. I know it's ridiculous, but it's just very sad. Now, since you, because you're asking, these are all, I'm like tying in all of your questions. They're actually all connected, and I'm showing you that at the same time while answering them. So Dugin, since you're asking about that, is an expert in Western occultism, and the question is there like an Eastern occultism, or, you know, maybe like a Russian occultism? And the answer to that, in the sense that we mean it, would be no. Because occultism in the West is a particular product of first Lutheranism, the Protestant Reformation, and also, so that was based upon, I mean, sort of some of the impetus for that within the church in Northern Europe was based in a revulsion to the church's practices with regard to like the occult itself, because the church at this time in the 15 and 1600s, the Catholic Church in Northern Europe had integrated, was actually, you know, like, how would you explain like syncretic religions, like in like Catholicism in the Afro-Caribbean, right? With the different, like the dolls and stuff like that. And figurines, but then they can also represent, like, they can translate into being, saints, like patron saints in the Catholic Church as well. They have like dual, right? So it wasn't just the idolatry, that's just like the very basic category, like almost a confusing category, almost a misleading category. The issue was like necromancy. And you have fuckers like John Dee running around. I learned more recently in the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, 3, 4 years. Guy I was working with had been studying this. So, Dugin is like an expert in for the Russians on Western occultism and Western occult institutions as part of an intelligence operation. And so of the Russian intelligence, system. I don't know if it falls directly within like the SVR, like the Russian Foreign Service intelligence, or whatever the it is. So anyway. A lot of the older, a lot of the archival information on occultism is like in different like kind of libraries of occult book collectors of and things like this and participate like in authentic book trading in occult antiquities, antique and antique books. Many of these like describe the some of the rituals and things like this. Okay, so the you can investigate an area of research for your homework could be, the occult symbolism. And or rituals involving devouring a face or cutting a face off, things like this. But what we could say more definitively is that occult practices tie together the elites from different regions of the world of the global cabal, so that they keep allegiances based upon this occult affinity, even if the, let's say the practical geopolitical economic whatever situation of the country indicates that they should form a different alliance, and that so it keeps sort of blocks going in an irrational way. And this is connected to sea power. This is directly connected to the idea of a thalassocracy, because land powers are continental and adjacent, and because people just didn't appear, in their present locations last Tuesday, adjacent peoples have like long histories, and even though together, that forms the basis of cooperation, and also like land projects, like pipelines, or like rail and road, okay, that connect multiple countries of people that have like these histories. Let me back up and say that a lot of our thinking from Western 20th century institutions and academia that talk about, oh yeah, like these inherent enemies as being like next door neighbor countries, is a false construct that has been perpetuated by the British. And it's gone into the historical society, and no one's involved in the conspiracy. It's just embedded into the thinking for the past 200 years, 150 years. At the level of the academy and areas of history and the way they interpret things. And that's supposed to, but really what they're doing is that could be like, well, you could say predictive programming, okay, for that, how the British actually did things, how they tried to create Iran, Iraq, things like that, okay, Ukraine, Russia, how foreign powers, let's say either the Ottomans or the Austrians created the fall. Also, like Croatian Serbian division, things like that, over religion, over like a sorry, it's even more, it's over a division within, you know, the same religion. So anyway, you have while the actual existing infrastructural, okay, and physical realities of adjacent countries and growing land powers bring peoples and leadership together over reasons that are both like apparent and abundant, material and I would say empirical, right? Also, the vulnerabilities, you see, if you have three countries aligned in a row and there's a pipeline that connects them, right, or a railroad or, you know, a highway or something for goods, right, because they're in a trade block or something like that, all right, like the country in the middle, okay, if it's, like, not happy with things, it can kind of, you know, budge to slow things down, and it makes the countries kind of downstream have to respond to that. And if they're good diplomatically, and if they don't get out of hand with it, and they can edge it in their way. If a country is unreasonable about it, of course, then the other countries can be like, are directly invested into a solution that all goes towards the thing starts moving again. So that country could be subject to be even intervened on if they became crazy, but it connects these countries, you see. Of course, if they're like in, you have in, but by sea powers, boats can go anywhere. And if you built a civilization for the past 500 years on the basis of sea power, where ports, like seaports, were like the main focus of everything. Does that make sense what I'm talking about? And the way that the British have always framed history is that they make it seem like land powers are like kind of have this hoardish element to them. Okay. Even the way we talk about the Mongols is based in, that would be an accurate way when we talk about Said's Orientalism. That would be a good place to explain that or to show as an example of that, right? How the West views the Mongol horde. Ask Mongolians what they think about it. I don't think they think the same thing. So, with that part of the world, of course, you have Khazars. And, but there's a lot of misinformation and, like, in my opinion, wrong thinking about the subject of Khazars, because it's just people think that it's accurate before really kind of getting into the problems in our categories in history itself. So, I mean, if you thought that Khazars were uniquely or exclusively Jewish, then, or if you thought that the word Khazar was etymologically disconnected from the word czar or khan, and all of the relationships to the, you know, Islamic and Christian or Oriental world, all those things combined, that's kind of more descriptive of Khazar. And the Khazar realm was a, you know, basically a multi-ethnic polyglot region in the north to northeast Black Sea basin, where, you know, you have like the Sea of Azov and the Crimean Peninsula as well, although the Crimean times more independent. But at any rate, the significance of the Crimean Peninsula vis-a-vis the the Khazars is that it was the vehicle for which the trade and the things the Khazars were doing got into the Black Sea and then was connected to the Greco-Roman world and things like this. And that was through Greek traders. And for reasons that, if you understand my ideas talking about the subject prior, wherever there were Greeks, there were Jews. These Greeks were Jews. As you've, you know, understood and you've verified already when I made the claim previously, and you've already gone and fact-checked it, that Greek and Hebrew have the same alphabet, but Hebrew is reversed. Or you can say one is left to right and the other is right to left, but it's actually the characters are just mere images. I suggested the cause for this could be the way that, I don't know why other people didn't come up with this before, that, see, you have engravings, right? You have like stone or like cylinder scroll from which you make copies, okay? But there's two different ways to make rubbings. There's like a way that you put the ink on the actual, like the engraving side itself, right? So then the paper goes over it and then you rub, and then there's a type that you put the paper up against the thing and then you rub from the outside. So you would get mirror image, you know, variations doing it either way based upon the same, you know, starting thing. So whether you did it one way or the other, starting with the same tablet, let's say, right? That you're rubbing from. And you know, how you're doing that is going to be geographic, because it'll be based upon what type of inks and papers or leathers are available locally, right? And different materials that you have locally are going to be conducive to which process is going to be, you know, the best one to do. But then over quick time with tradition, that's how people recognize the alphabet, you know, this way to that way instead of that way to the other. But you have even though Khazars are linguistically considered to be Turkic, again, this contradicts that this was a polyglot and polyethnic state, because you had Aryan and then like the Finnic and Ugric Turkic groups also, like both Finnic and Ugric Turkic groups. You had Slavs, like whatever that is, like whatever kind of, you're supposed to talk about, see, nowadays you're supposed to talk about somatic elements and not genetic elements, because even though they now say that race is part of a debunked theory, at the same time they have to explain that even in the research from 2011-2012, as I understood, the writing on the nature of Khazar has them as a inner Asian Mongoloid people. They're an IAM, yeah, inner Asian Mongoloid people, IAM. And you have inner Asian Aryans. I mean, you have inner Asian Caucasians, right? Like, or inner Asian, like Persians, right? And inner Asian Mongoloids. Even, you know, but the problem is that in academia and different institutions, even though you can get a degree in one and it counts in the other, are producing different materials, and then, you know, so you wind up with there's a big crisis in the West with how this works. The different fields, the people who say that everything is a social construct also say that everything should be socially constructed in the way that they want it to be constructed. Have you noticed that? And they've been taking over in the universities, like, in a very serious and dangerous way. But it was like kind of already shit when I was there within the department, like affected, that are connected to political philosophy and things like that. or international relations, because within political department, political science department, right, all of it. But what happens when this goes into like chemistry and biology and things like that? Well, now you've seen how they explain that, right? With sex and gender. Despite the fact that this concept, this is like this thing that sex and gender are distinct, is like only made possible because of Protestants didn't like to see the word sex on forms. Yes, Protestants didn't like to see the word sex. I'm sure Catholics didn't either, but I mean, the activist groups are, you know, just because of the demographics of the U.S., more Protestant than Catholic. So it's not, I'm not picking on the, I'm not trying to say that it's a Protestant thing, but they, it is a Northern European thing, because in Europe, I think Protestantism is more of an expression of other things, somatically Northern European. So you're supposed to say somatic now is the result of all of this. So somatically Turkic and Slavic and Persian people made up the Khazars. And I connect Khazar to any word or toponym that you see on a map, including, you know, struggles that Russia had. With the any word that has like KH sound or KHS, KHZ, like Khosak, I connect Khazars to Khosaks. I think it's the same thing. Shoot me, that's fine. But I believe that Khosak and Khazar are just different variations. And I think Hussar also falls in that category. That's just my make of things, from my own opinion, looking at how I've made sense of all of this over the years, of just like you know, reading what you find and just kind of making sense of these contradictions and things like that. And I think that the Khwarizm is also a very good clue as to Khazars. And then, because also look at the Caspian Sea is also known as the Khazar Sea. And the Khwarizm, there's your KH, you know, Z, are right there. Could be also KH, you know. Yeah, KHZ are good letters to look for, or KZ, HZ. And quarters of them are like Persian, or a mix of Persians and Turks also, basically. I think when they say Slavic in this context, they mean the distinct of what modern, let's say, ethnic Russians are. So that's like a backwards categorization, because it doesn't mean that something can be multi-ethnic something can be polysomatic but mono-ethnic, right? And people with Slavic DNA may not have, or what we now backwards project to say that, well, this is a historical group that we now call Slav, would have been part of these Khazar groups, okay, without ever having been culturally, what we think of as culturally Slav. These are just, they're only making that inference based upon somatic categorizations, but we make somatic categorizations. Anytime human beings make categorizations, there is a value that we're judging, and the value being the parameters of the category that we've established. So there's there's always a subjective in the categorization, even though all the information looking at, you know, could be objective empirical. See, the parameters of the thing that you're looking at determine what you'll find. And the parameters of the thing that we are looking at is a social construct or an individual choice, but it's not obvious, nor is it a fact of nature. So, and that's the lens through which I look at this question of Khazar. And I don't think of it, they were not uniquely Jewish, but the connection to the Crimean Peninsula is through the Crimean Peninsula, Judaism and Christianity grew. Christianity been introduced also by land routes, and the way that the like Kievan Rus was established out of the Varangian guard named Rurik, who was made by the Romans of the period. This is like post-Justinian period, so it's already, you could talk about the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire at this time. But the Khazars existed in a relatively similar area, maybe just a tad east to the original Rus state that had a city in Kiev by the kind of appointed by the Romans, led by Rurik. Interestingly, it is also a Rurik that is the founder of Galicia, by the way. So it's strange that the Galician Nazis think that they're something the way that Czechs can imagine and pretend that they're Germans sometimes. They can imagine and pretend that they're actually Germans whose great-great-grandparents were taught Slavic by accident or because there was too many remaining Sorbians or Poles nearby. Actually, I think Moravia was one of the first big, powerful Slavic states. Let me look at the questions on the... So when you try to look at the question of Khazars, the thing is that people get very charged about it. And the thing is that a lot of conspiracy theories about Khazars are connected to ideas about the origin of Ashkenazi Jews, which is a phenomenon that, and we're going to help you understand this now, that is separated by 800 or 900 years. So you may not be talking about maybe that much related people, because this, what you would call foundation of modern rabbinical Judaism, right, by which you would be meaning, of course, Talmudic Judaism, is only possible after the experience of the Frankists, etc., and among Ashkenazi Judaism. But these are events that don't take place until, like, you know, a period of time between the 1600s, 1700s, out of Jewish groups that existed in the Ottoman Empire, but, you know, of the Ottoman Empire of the, which is now Russian Federation or Ukraine. But Khazar language and Bulgar language, Bulgarian, are said to be most similar in structure, which lines up with the view of other linguists that Bulgarian appears to have a effectively like lowercase S Serbian vocabulary placed within a Turkic, syntax or, word order or, sentence logic. So whenever you get these kind of independent theories that line up, it does help, but this is not an area that I'm entitled to have, a defendable opinion on. These are just the things that I've found and have thought to myself in varying ways over the years. But if the way I reason about it makes sense to you, this is just how I've tried to make sense of it to myself. What people are referring to with Ashkenazi Judaism is sort of this culmination and breaking, reforming and rejecting out of trends that developed from the from the Sabbateans, from Sabbati Zevi, and then Frank. And these were all just in the past number of centuries. This is not ancient history. Certainly doesn't go back to the Khazars. I would propose, first of all, then, that because Talmudic Judaism, the origins of it, you can't even say it would have been established as originally, of course, as the smallest minority of people within Judaism. But that couldn't have been until prior to the 7th or 8th century, because several authoritative Torahs were still being produced until then. You had Damascus or Babylon and Torah, right? Or the, any rate, forgive me where I'm wrong on the details, but these are certainly these were still being produced until the 7th or 8th century. I think one's from the 3rd or 4th century AD. But you have a Jerusalem Talmud and a Babylon Talmud, something like this. Anyway. But it wasn't even possible until you had in like the medieval Spain and Moses of Leon, as I recall, and his sort of discovery, which was popular at this time. The Renaissance is full of discovering ancient works, which may have just been written by the people who wrote them or who transcribed that last copy before it was caught in that fire, disintegrated into dust. That's actually the description of what's happened to all the primary source documents of the from the Greco-Roman period, antiquity, history, by the Renaissance transcribers, is that they, shortly after being transcribed, thank God they caught to it in time, they caught on fire or disintegrated finally after having survived for up to 3,800 years. In the case of describing, early ancient antiquity, or it would have been 3,300 years, 500 years ago, just disintegrated spontaneously. So, and likewise, I don't know if there's actually an older work that does not exist in publication, but it's what's referenced in the Zohar, you see. Anyway, but you could go on from there, but despite that being my opinion on the Zohar, You can't establish, you know, Talmudic Judaism until the synthesis of what may have been more similar to the practices of the Good Samaritans or something like that, and you know, Mosaic Judaism, and the rabbinical cast from the time. You know, by then, there was some, whatever, 600 and something laws on how to live, based upon the Ten Commandments, but based upon, like, the, you know, interpretation of the, of everything in the stories, and the, so, but this is not, none of this yet is still the same thing as contemporary Talmudic Judaism, which is a little misleading to say Talmudic, because you think, oh, so it goes back to the maybe 8th century AD, but not even here, because it first, it then requires this influence of Moses de Leon, who moves from Spain. That's not until whatever, the 13th century, some shit like that, right? And it, and forgive me, I just need my second cup of coffee. This is just my best recollection of things, just conversationally. Okay, don't crucify me if I get like a name, date, or attribute a concept to the person wrong or something. I'm not here like as a, you know, expert in this. These are just the things that occur to me when I'm pooping or taking a shower. You know what I mean? You start to go, wait a minute. So I'm the guy from that meme. I'm the guy from that meme where the guy and the gal are laying on the bed and he's kind of turned away with his eyes open. He's like clearly thinking about something, but not giving her affection. And she's there like with her arms crossed thinking, I bet he's thinking about her, this other, whatever, this other whore. And then, I don't think women are whores. Women think that, you know, other women that are after their men are whores. They have to be. It's like the rule. Fucking whore. So, and she's thinking, he's thinking like about, you know, Einstein and some shit. So you have like, yeah, there was this guy on YouTube who showed, who totally walks you through Einstein's field equation in relativity and then general relativity. He explains the whole thing in the most understandable way. And then he explains how modern mathematicians have extrapolated it all wrong. And it fascinated me. I just love that this stuff is available on YouTube. I'd be like in the shower and something thinking about it. Wow, that's really, get these little epiphanies. Yeah, I'm aware that Einstein worked in a patent office and had access to other people's ideas. Darwin's ideas also, like, weren't really his. But, yeah, I think, let me see, just ending or rounding out then, the last question that I'm going to do is on the mobilization. Oh, well, I'll finish with the Khazar point. It's just inaccurate to connect Khazars to Ashkenazi Judaism, first of all, okay? You just have too many centuries. You have too much ethnogenesis in between. The Ashkenazis at this time, by the time we're talking about, are ethnoculturally Slavic people. Through and through, all of, you know, Ashkenazi Judaica, and I didn't find this out until later, that everything from dancing the Hora to potato latkes had nothing to do with Judaism, and it was all actually like with all the Polish people and Ukrainians and Serbs and Bulgarians have been doing all along. So it's kind of weird. Anyway, then on the issue of these anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, therefore, tend to center around, connecting the Western branch of Judaism, which has been in Europe since in the time of like William the Conqueror in the 12th century. Okay, these are long time or indigenous, because you have to already, you see, we could expand different directions. Okay, there's first of all the fallacy that I have an opinion. I say fallacy, no, okay, I have a fucking opinion that that Judaism relates to a socioeconomic class that was kind of categorized by Christianity, and that a lot of the Judaism, Talmudic Judaism, is a refutiate is separately, of course, it has its own things. It doesn't revolve around Christianity, but it dedicates areas to denouncing Christ, saying that he's boiling in excrement and things like that. That's just there. That's just there. Okay, and it's not doesn't mean that people have to believe when people are part of religion that they believe every part of it or whatever. That's just not how things work in the world. And we're not here to condemn any religion or certainly not individuals or to categorize people in any way like that. Okay. We're just talking about ideas and, the hithers and druthers and here's fors and wherefores of them. You hear me criticize, well, this whole thing until now has been talking about Christianity, right? And the craziness within that was happening in the church with the necromancy and then, and the Martin Luther and all these things. Martin Luther being against necromancy, to be clear. to be clear about that. But it just Judaism just didn't exist, is what I'm saying, in the way that anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists think about it. In the 8th century AD or 9th century AD, when Khazars were about, you see what I mean? There wasn't, you see, there was. Let me I'll go further, okay? I'll go further, okay? You have to, if you think of, there, instead of looking for instead of looking at Judaism in terms of the people of it, instead of thinking about it as being like a group that came from one location or two locations and then migrated, okay, think of it as a religion that traveled by sea, like by merchants, by Greeks, okay? Think of Judaism as a religion spread primarily by, it's this kind of, it's, when I say Greeks, you have to understand that you have Hellenized Jews, right? But then Hellenized Jews living and speaking Greek in the Greek world. You see what I'm saying? Like it doesn't just mean that they're in Judea and becoming Hellenized, like walking around in togas and see what I'm saying, whatever the fuck, right? You see, no, they actually like were part of this, and there were Phoenicians and Carthaginians and Romans, right? But So wherever you have Roman cities and wherever you have this, okay, wherever you had Greek traders in the broader sense of the Greco-Roman world in France and England and whatever, okay, because you had Greeks, you had Jews, not for conspiracy reasons and not for crazy reasons, but just that's how history happened. So there wasn't like some 16th century or 15th century secret migration of Ashkenazi Jews into Western Europe to like take over financial institutions or something like this. This is a anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. But in Western Europe, produced its own indigenous religion, also called Judaism, among the descendants of Greek and Hellenized Jewish and Roman colonists, or urban livers, urban people living in the urban parts that were the established colonies of the Greek-Roman power system of building forts and building markets, controlling trade routes, right? And the conversion to the conversion to Judaism by the these kind of Turkic people who before had practiced like a Tengrism around this time was influenced by the Crimean Jews who were there because of the Greeks and the Romans. Like that's, it was they it is, there's some idea, there's one theory that it was it was they landed on Judaism also was geostrategically neutral because they were trading between the Christian world to their, if you're looking at a map, to their left, and the Islamic world to their right and to their south and things like that. And so that was a trade route, like from all the way from China to into the markets of the traveling troubadours, and markets in the traveling festivals in France, in medieval France. So yes, did some also like Khazar traders like just decide to take a permanent residence across different places too? Yes, also that. But there's also a big, it really is not until the 1800s that you have like these more concerted efforts to make uniform. There's like big reform movements to make uniform Judaism, and it's being led by Hasidim in the 1800s, Orthodox Jews, which Orthodox doesn't mean oldest. That's not what that means. It just means the right way. It can be some new thing you figured out, technically speaking, and it be the right way. And that's actually the claim, I think, whether they acknowledge that or not, because they had to go through the process of two failed messiahs, a period of time of indulging in a theology where maybe God is farther removed than we believed, and the coming of the Messiah is a more hopeless or farther thing than we would have wanted. And this is sorrowful. And as I understand, even though the later synthesis out of that rejected the first conclusion out of the Sabbatean and Frankish experience of failed messiahs, I think they rejected the idea finally that we should not expect a Messiah, and came back to the idea that indeed the Messiah will come. And that is where most of the mainstream, of course, like the Lubavitches and think maybe the Messiah is their guy already, you know. And then there's another guy who's super interesting, who, when he died, appears to have the oldest living rabbi, we can talk about him later, appears to have said that Jesus was the Messiah. That's debated, but it's, you know, you can look at some of the arguments and decide for yourself. We might get into that in another talk. On the question of the Russian conscription, in Russian support for the war is at an all-time high. Of course, even in the mainstream Russian news portals, they admit that there has been a Ukrainian counteroffensive that has found success. That in fact they did have one, that they did take some settlements, but that these aren't, they don't think that this is stable. Of course, linguistically or propagandistically, they would have to say that, I think, even if that weren't the case. So it remains to be seen, in my view, what will happen. But nevertheless, support in Russia for the special military operation remains high. Riding on the wave of Russia expanded, and as you have the this sort of sense of mission and purpose that's shared, now is the time to conscript. Yes, they have whatever, 1,800,000, 1.1 million, whatever, however you figure out, depends on if you include potato peelers or people who are presently like on a 4-day week shift or something like that. But yeah, you have, you know, 1.2 million already in the military, minus however many they lost in the special military operation. But I don't believe that that's like 370,000. I think that number will go north. Could reach 500,000, actually, but it would be about half volunteers. And that is only possible if there's support. So I think they do it now. See, they may have to do it later. They don't have to do it now. And that's the time to do it. If they did it when they had to do it, it would be seen as desperation. It would be seen as, and the support for the war might be less. People will like, you know, to support things that are winning. And people, unfortunately, most patriots are summertime soldiers. And most people go on about their lives and things like that. So now is the time to conscript. Now is the time to do it. And then you still have the guys, you know, who are in the military already. I mean, not in the reserves, but in active duty now, who are all jacked up on it too, you see. And that's why you do it now. You don't do it after you lost. Okay. Also, all of their best, often what you do is when, okay, even though you establish new units, okay, you bring people out of one unit. It's like cellular division. Okay. So that the experience and the traits from the older unit are partially conferred upon the new unit you establish, so that when they train, they're training with guys with experience, and when they're out in the field, you don't have a green unit. So they're kind of dispersed across, even though you overall have to create new units, they're integrated into existing battalion structures. And then in terms of the actual people, they'll have like one or two green guys with five or six experienced guys, is how it kind of breaks down. So they're doing it because they don't need to. They're doing it because they have the public support. And people are not. You see, the whole Russians are fleeing the draft story is not a fake story. It's just a story from the future of a different timeline that the Russians are presently redirecting. Okay? That's all. And with that, I bid you a good morning and a farewell. Peace. I'm out.